Barry Glasner says we are being tyrannized by images of the perfect body. Some people think of the current obsession with thinness and fitness as a fad, but Glasner is a sociologist, and he's not ready to dismiss these trends that easily. He wants to know why the lean, exercised look is so popular and what it tells us about society and ourselves. He responds to these questions in his new book, Bodies, Why We Look the Way We Do and How We Feel About It. The book is based in part on a series of interviews Glasner conducted with 90 people around the country. He spoke with men and women about self-image and also interviewed experts such as image consultants, plastic surgeons, and health spa directors. Glasner chairs the sociology department at the University of Connecticut. In his new book, Glasner observes that the landscape has been overrun by images of idealized beauty.
I think that when you just open up a magazine or turn on the television these days, you see it all around you. The images that we're asked to use as mirrors to compare ourselves, our bodies, these are all people who look very, very much different than the way most of us look. You know, they're thinner. They have sort of non-fat, non-smoking, Nautilus-built bodies that just are not very much like what most Americans look like.
Well, you ask a very good question in your book. It seems like an obvious question, but it's one I don't think we ask very much, and that is, why do images of beautiful people hold so much appeal?
Yeah, that was a great mystery for me. That was one of the reasons that I started out to investigate this whole question, go around the country and interview people. And I think the key to that answer is that they stand for so much that's good in this society. I think that we've invested our sort of personal and public morality in these images. They stand for sort of traditional American values, you know, like self-control and prosperity and personal accomplishment and of course, beauty. A person who looks like that, we think, has everything good. They're good people and they're doing well. I think another reason that's quite separate from that is just really purely materialistic, that to make it these days in many corporations and in many kinds of activities in our society, you'd better at least give evidence that you're trying to meet that image, you know, that you're trying to give up smoking or you're trying to lose some weight or that you go down to the health club every day after work. If you look at classified ads for jobs, help wanted ads, it's not uncommon anymore to see these requirements specified per se. Clean, preppy look you see in ads, right? Your good looks count here. I saw an ad that said that. This is very overt, very above board now. It's no longer just implicit.
But here's a curious thing. You know, if images of beautiful people are being used in part to sell products to us on television, and it holds an appeal to us at the same time, a lot of people get really kind of jealous and angry when they see this idealized image that they know they'll never be able to reach themselves. So in a way, it's almost like a love-hate relationship, I think, many people have with this ideal.
Yeah, there was a psychoanalyst who wrote about this, a brilliant psychoanalyst, Otto Fenichel, who said that, and I'm grossly paraphrasing here, that we want to be like the person, we want to take on some of their qualities when we see another in this kind of longing way, but at the same time we're angry at the object, at the image. We're angry for precisely the reason you mentioned, that we can't have these qualities, that we try to take them on, but we're doomed to failure. And you see, when we think about the health and fitness movement, when we talk about it normally, it's always entirely in positive terms. And I'm not at all anti-fitness and health. I think it's wonderful that people have become more concerned to get more physical exercise and a healthier diet and so forth. But we never talk about the negative sides. We never talk about the pain that comes along with all of this emphasis on the ideal body. And when I went around the country conducting interviews for this book, Bodies, that's something I kept hearing. I kept hearing about the pain that was associated with this, about people who took up programs and failed. And I kept finding statistics about this. You know, 50% of people who take up exercise programs drop out. Only 2% of dieters maintain their reduced weight. This means lots of failures, lots of, excuse the expression, lower self-esteem. And probably, in the end, it's not even good for personal health when that happens to people. For people for whom it works, it's wonderful.
Well, this leads to a paradox, which you get to in your book, which is that research shows that we're doing more for our bodies, but we're less satisfied with them.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. There was a very interesting poll taken by Psychology Today of its readers. They took it twice, in 1972 and then in 1985. And on every dimension they studied, Americans were less satisfied with their body, with their bodies, you know, with weight, with various regions of their bodies, their face, their chest, their abdomen, and so forth, in 1985 than they were in 72. And of course, 85 was the height of the fitness craze by most measures. We didn't even feel stronger, that poll and others also showed. People were less satisfied with their muscle tone, even though more of them had become more involved. There are a number of studies showing that this has not had the kind of positive effect overall that would be hoped for or that might be anticipated.
Do you have an explanation for that paradox?
Yeah, I think that what's been created is escalating and unrealistic kinds of images, goals for people that they just can't meet. Most of us simply can't achieve what we're supposed to achieve. You know, 30 million women between 25 and 50 wear size 16 or larger, right? The probability that they're going to end up looking like the women in those magazines is slim. And for men, by the way, I like to say that this is the first co-ed book on bodies because there have been a number of books about this kind of concern, but they haven't looked both at men and women. And men, percentages are going up of men, for men who are dissatisfied, especially with their upper body strength and their general shape.
Well, let me ask you about that. I want to reintroduce you first. My guest is Barry Glassner, and he's the author of the new book, Bodies, Why We Look the Way We Do and How We Feel About It. The ideals for men and women have changed. For women, it's thinner and more muscular. For men, more muscular and, more carefully dressed, more hairdos. You say that it kind of gets back to control, that the post-war obsession in America is control, and I'd like for you to explain that.
I think one thing that came out over and over again when I conducted these interviews, when people would talk to me about what they get out of their health and fitness regimen, what came out time and again was this word control. You know, I say in the book, if I had a dollar for every time I heard it, I could buy a health club. The kinds of control they're talking about are control, obviously, over their weight and over their future health and so forth, but not just that. Also control over their emotions, control over their personal well-being, you know, self-satisfaction, that sort of thing. I found a really fascinating study of women's magazines that looked at women's magazines from the 1940s through the 70s. Self-control was the most frequently mentioned topic, more frequently mentioned than love or friendship or beauty or wealth or any of these concerns. And in the last 10 or 15 years, a key way that many middle-class people, at least, have tried to develop that feeling of having self-control, of being in control, is by way of perfecting or trying to perfect their bodies. And, of course, as we said before, so many are failing. And at the same time, there's a lot of guilt that goes along that with that and blaming people when they fail. So that actually achieving a greater sense of control or self-esteem doesn't come out of these activities for lots of people. For those for whom it does, and I discuss quite a few of them in the book also, it's really wonderful to see. I mean, you do find people who go out and rigorously maintain their exercise schedules and their diet who really benefit very much from it. But that's one part of the story.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that this obsession with control is more of a middle-class obsession?
That seems to be what the national statistics show, right? The percentage of people who smoke is higher among the poor and working class. They're more obese, poor and working class people, fewer get regular exercise programs and so forth. Of course, a lot of that has to do with time and money. I mean, that's this ideal body that so many people are after is a status symbol now, because you have to have the time to work on it, you have to have the money to buy the right diet, the right kind of food and so forth to achieve it. I found a big difference in philosophies between the people I interviewed who were poor, working class, and middle, upper middle class people. And this sort of echoed a study that was conducted by a fellow named Robert Crawford, a political scientist, about 10 years ago. There's a kind of raise yourself up by your bootstraps, you know, a Horatio Alger notion among the middle class and the upper middle class, that, you know, the road to happiness and good health and long life is paved with diets and exercise programs and with great self-control and so forth. The poor and working class folks have a very different view, that health and well-being is all about having freedom, being able to be strong enough, have enough energy and time enough to go out and do what you want to do, to be able to have a few beers, you know, to be able, you know, sometimes part of the image, especially among younger males, is to be able to drive fast and smoke and survive it, right? A very different kind of notion, and one that these days is thought of as simply wrong-headed, right? That's simply foolishness, okay? And of course, probably they're taking greater risks than middle-class people by when they hold to those kinds of views.
I want to get to another paradox in your book, which is filled with paradoxes. And this is that among the people you interviewed, those who were unattractive or disfigured were not the most distressed about their looks. The people who already resembled the media idols, the people who were fairly or very attractive, they were the ones who worked hardest to look better. How do you explain that?
Yeah, you know, I remember as you say that, an image comes to mind of a man I interviewed who was sort of rotund, flabby fellow. Based on the insurance tables, he'd be very much overweight, who was completely satisfied, as near as I could tell, with the way he looked, and he certainly seemed to be. And he said something to me that sort of nailed it down for me, and I'm paraphrasing. He said, if I became skinny, it would just be like putting on another set of clothes. There'd be the same person inside of those clothes. And I found time and again people who had no hope, really, no matter how hard they worked, of approaching the ideal. At some point in their lives, many of them had come to terms with this. They'd found their own strengths, what they liked about themselves, and simply were no longer pursuing this ideal. The people who were most obsessed with it tended to be folks who had some chance, usually remote, of actually achieving it, or were really pretty close, you know. And they then wanted to perfect their bodies, really very much resemble what they saw in the magazines.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk more with you about our obsessions with how we look. My guest, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Barry Glasner. We're discussing the subject of his new book, Bodies, Why We Look the Way We Do and How We Feel About It. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Speaking with Barry Glasner, author of the new book, Bodies. Fitness has become a multi-million dollar industry. How much of our obsession with the way we look do you think is fed by recruiting for health clubs, by diet food ads on television, by exercise videotapes, things like that that give us the idea of what the ideal is and what we need to buy to reach it?
Yeah, a lot of the activity is really very much based around the kind of economy that's been set up to support it. You know, it feeds on itself that way, and it becomes very difficult for people to escape that net. Right, there are now at least 50,000 corporations that have corporate fitness and wellness programs, which are in general a good thing, of course, to give people that added benefit in their benefits package. But it also suggests to employees that they bloody well better take care of themselves and attend these sorts of programs. if they want promotion, if they want to be integrated into the firm and so forth. And, you know, you really can't – well, let me put it a different way. A friend of mine from Europe who was over here said, you know, the last time I was here, shopping malls were popping up everywhere. Now it seems like the countryside here is littered with health clubs. You know, you just can't – you can't miss them. For people who enjoy it, for people who use their memberships, they're great things. You know, I'm certainly not anti-health club. But the promotion has really tightened the net. I think, though, to answer your question another way, it's what's happened is that so many influential sectors of the culture have gathered together to make personal health the nexus for our public and personal morality, that it becomes the entire discourse about public good, public morality, and so forth. The medical profession, of course, is very much involved with this. I had my annual physical last week, and at the end of the physical, the doctor, who I thought was a wonderful physician, and gave me a great physical, ended by spending 4 or 5 of the precious minutes giving me a little lecture about cholesterol. Now, what was interesting about this is that she had seen that my cholesterol level was within the normal range, right? So why was she giving me this particular talk? Well, because that's the way you end up physicals these days. You tell people they should eat fewer eggs and so forth. What I would love to see is for us to expand this kind of health concern away from these immediate kinds of measures. I mean, it would be wonderful if sometimes she asked me not only for a sample of my blood, you know, but for a sample of the air that was recirculated in the building where I work, you know, or water from my tap to see how much lead was in it. You know.
So you think that our emphasis on making ourselves be fit and look good is distracting our attention away from certain environmental hazards that we have no control over, but, say, our employees, our employers or industry might?
Right. I think that we have decided on some subconscious level over the last 10, 15 years that these external problems, especially environmental problems, are just so overwhelming, so far out of control, that we'd better become invincible, right? Better be able to take care of ourselves and be strong and able to resist them. That's all for the good to a certain extent, except that as we're starting to see with the greenhouse effect and so forth, the environmental problems seem to be getting worse. And what I found in talking to people in interviews for Bodies is that there's great fear about this. Many of the people who are very much obsessed with exactly what they eat and getting just the right amount of exercise and so forth are also very concerned about radon in their homes, about pesticides on their food, and that sort of concern, but aren't doing anything about that, you see. They are doing a lot about what they
eat. What's the kind of thing that
you
feel is out of your control, you know?
Right, but how much is it out of one's control? Mm-hmm. You know, there are plenty of organizations devoted to this kind of activity, and you know, I'm not particularly an environmental activist, environmentalist for that matter. But if one is very much concerned about these kinds of issues, you know, the amount of time that people spend on their personal health in some cases is disproportionate. Why couldn't some of that time be spent on other kinds of collective activities? And you know what's interesting about that is that there's a whole body of studies, of literature, suggesting that people who get involved in their communities, who help others, who become active collectively, tend to live longer and are healthier. Yeah, that's.
Are they thinner?
Are they thinner?
And I think that would be the key question.
I suppose it depends on how active you are in that pursuit, right?
I want to ask you about cosmetic surgery. You were talking a little bit before about how you think that some of the obsession with good looks is class related. That the issue of control seems to be more of a middle class issue. Cosmetic surgery might possibly be something that would really separate the looks of the affluent from the looks of the poor, because those who can afford it can afford to have, you know, crow's feet removed and chins tucked and noses shortened and those kinds of things. Are you very concerned about this trend of increasing reliance on cosmetic surgery?
I'm finding it to be, interestingly, just an extension of what's been going on in these other areas that we've been talking about. I found a very interesting ad for a cosmetic surgery practice. I think it was in Southern California, where there was a photograph of an attractive woman. The caption said something like, I eat right, I exercise, and I have plastic surgery. Right. You know, and then the notion now is that this is all one package, right? And that if you just do all of these things, you'll be happy and you'll live forever and so forth. And of course, you know, there is some truth to it. I also found a study that a good national study actually a few years ago, showing that the more attractive a person is on average, the higher their income, right? So you know, there are payoffs. And of course, many of those who are going for extensive cosmetic surgery, I don't know about many, I should correct that, certainly a proportion, are having that surgery paid for out of company health programs. And it is to the company's benefit that they improve their looks.
I guess one of the frightening things about cosmetic surgery is that the ideal of how one should look becomes more and more impossible to achieve. I mean, it only becomes surgically possible to achieve it. And I think people who are in a kind of borderline frame of mind of like not really caring that much, but on the other hand, not wanting to look bad, feel more and more pressured to consider something like cosmetic surgery because it's their only hope for fitting at all into the ideal.
Right. And you know, more generally than that, we spend a lot of our time worrying that we're doing just the right thing in all of these areas. You know, should I today after work go home and read that new novel that I would so much enjoy reading, or should I go for my workout, you know, or should I spend the money on the vacation or the cosmetic surgery kinds of concerns. You see, my personal concern about this is more that it's one more item in a big package, and that so much money is being spent on this kind of concern that could be going elsewhere. For some people, though, there are also very, very careful studies showing that there are clearly people who benefit from cosmetic surgery. That is, it improves their mental health, at least in the short run. It allows them to get on with, you know, their lives without certain obsessions that have preoccupied them. That's part of, you know, you've been mentioning the paradoxes in the book, and I kept coming across them. And, you know, one of the paradoxes is this, that there's so many pros and so many cons to all of these body concerns.
Well, sure. Listen, I mean, say you're feeling really self-conscious because you have a big nose. And you don't really believe in cosmetic surgery, but you've gotten so self-conscious about it because the ideal has gotten so out of reach that you decide to go for that surgical procedure. I mean, that's a real paradox. It would be giving into something that you don't believe in, but you feel so insecure, you know you'll feel better if you have the surgery.
That's right. That's right. But, you know, what that continues, of course, is a kind of metaphor of doing battle with your body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think part of the change that is gradually coming about, partly under the influence of New Age kinds of concerns, which I have certain problems with in their own right, but they're moving toward a metaphor of developing peace with one's body, rather than this continuous battle, and I think that's for the good. You know, I think we go back and forth on this, and in the culture about which approach we want.
Now, I think you referred to this earlier, but you say that the most disturbing statistic you've come across in your research is from a Gallup poll that said 93% of Americans agree with this statement: if I take the right actions, I can stay healthy. And what worries you is the converse. That means that if you're not healthy, well, you did something to blow it, and it's probably your own fault.
Yeah. You know what was really disturbing to me when I went around the country doing these interviews is how much we've reverted back to blaming the victim. Blaming a person for their illnesses, blaming the victim. When a person becomes ill with heart disease or cancer, it's not uncommon now for their friends, for their family, for medical personnel to at least implicitly blame them. You know, if they'd gotten more exercise, if they just eaten fewer eggs in the morning, you know, whatever, this wouldn't have happened. But we know, of course, that it's a very complex matter. There are many variables in the equation, including genetic, a variety of social psychological variables, and so forth. And yet it's simpler now in, again, our public discourse to just narrow it, center everything around these individual kinds of changes that people can make. But we're leaving aside, you know, we talk about all the progress that's been made, right? Progress towards a healthier nation. And people who push the fitness revolution like to point to statistics of lower decreases in heart disease mortality and so forth. And that's all wonderful. I think it's great that we've achieved that. But during the same period, roughly the late 60s to present, there have been a variety of areas in which our public health has gotten worse. Right? There were 5 billion injuries on the job in 1986. That's up 13% from 1983. Right? The hunger statistics, which have a lot to do with health concerns, are much worse now than they were in the late 60s. We spend more of our GNP, of our gross national product, on health care than any other nation, but our infant mortality rate is 17th worst of 20 industrialized nations. I guess I'm saying that I think we've been premature in congratulating ourselves. Right? We can congratulate ourselves on having taken the individual actions, but not on having taken the social collective kinds of actions, leaving 37 million people uninsured. Right? And that number is up 25% just since 1980. I'm not blaming this, by the way. I want to hasten to add, because I've been accused of this. Not blaming fitness advocates for having brought kinds of statistics about. But I am suggesting that we can't keep distracting ourselves this way, and we can't keep thinking that we're going to solve the problems this way.
Barry Glassner, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you. Barry Glassner is the author of Bodies, Why We Look the Way We Do and How We Feel About It. It's published by Putnam. He's the chair of the sociology department at the University of Connecticut. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.